This afternoon, we're going to talk a little bit about some of the ideas contained in this letter of October 20th. And after that, I'm going to give you a little bit of an overview of development theory that existed outside of the Baha'i faith over the period of the last 20, 30, 40 years here in the Western world. Dwight is going to talk after that, and then we're going to break for our refreshments. After that, we're going to come back and we're going to break into discussion groups that will focus on the material contained within the letter of October 20th. And tonight, we'll continue the discussion, both of us, about social and economic development projects and focus a bit more on Africa and some of the things that are going on in Africa. I thought to begin with, I would give you some of the comments of Dr. Peter Kahn, who spoke to us on behalf of the International Teaching Center at the Auxiliary Board Conference in Lincolnwood in May. And he spent an afternoon speaking about the social and economic development ideas that were inherent in the letter and that the International Teaching Center had discussed. And I wanted to bring to you some of the background thinking that he told us about and one of the quotations that he read to us and referred us to. And by the way, when I was in Southern Africa, Councillor Hooper Dunbar was making a similar kind of trip to Councillor Peter Kahn's here in the United States. And he reiterated many of the things that Councillor Kahn told us when he was here in the United States and added some ideas which he felt were particularly relevant to the African situation. Now, Peter Kahn says that there were three fundamental principles underlying this letter. The first being that you cannot segregate the human heart from the outside environment. He had a quotation which came from a letter of Shoki Effendi's, which he said was as yet unpublished, but Mr. Dunbar alluded to the fact that there will be a compilation coming out soon on quotations which are relevant to these development issues, and that this would be included for us at this time. But the principle that you cannot segregate the human heart from the outside environment, that here we're involved again with the organic analogy of unity in the Baha'i faith, it makes a great deal of sense to us once it's stated and we begin to think about it, that there are all sorts of mutual actions and reactions from the inner life and the outer environment which interact on each other all the time. And we were talking last night about Maslow's ladder of human needs, of course there's the need to have food, and that is a basic need, one of those basic biological needs to keep from starving. But we can't isolate that from all of the other needs that we have of safety, interpersonal relationships, and relationship to a creator, and so on and so forth. Food is basic. Food keeps us from starving, but food isn't the only thing. And we have to realize that there are these mutual reactions and interactions both ways. In the same way, we can't just live on faith alone. We do have to have some material food and shelter to sustain us, too. The second fundamental principle underlying this letter refers to Baha'i worship itself. And there is a quotation in Baha'i Administration, which both of the counselors referred us to, which was written by Shoki Effendi in 1929. It's in a section on a letter talking about the purpose of the Magical Askar and what the worship services would be like in the Magical Askar and what this would be like in the future. If you want page references, it's Baha'i Administration. This section was page 184 to 187. I'm going to read you just a small section from page 185 and 186. Now, you know, Shoki Effendi's sentences are sometimes long, so I'll try to stop and go back over some key points here so that you won't get lost. Now, he's talking about the fact that worship service is not just going to be an eclectic kind of situation where people are going to be coming in from different religions and creating different kinds of services, but there's going to be a special kind of Baha'i service that's developed. And then he goes on to say, But however inspiring the conception of Baha'i worship as witnessed in the central edifice of this exalted temple, it cannot be regarded as the sole or nor even the essential factor in the part which the magical Azkar, as designed by Baha'u'llah, is destined to play in the organic life of the Baha'i community. So Baha'i worship is not going to be the only, the sole, or even the essential factor that the part of the magical Azkar will play in the Baha'i community. Now here's the key point. Divorced from the social, humanitarian, educational, and scientific pursuits centering around the dependencies of the magical Azkar, Baha'i worship, however exalted in its conception, however passionate in fervor, can never hope to achieve beyond the meager and often transitory results produced by the contemplation of the ascetic or the communion of the passive worshiper. Shall I go over that sentence again? We can't sit around and just worship. Divorced from the social, humanitarian, educational, and scientific pursuits centering around the dependencies of the magical Azkar, Baha'i worship, however exalted in its conception, however passionate in its fervor, can never hope to achieve beyond the meager and often transitory results produced by the contemplations of the ascetic or the communion of the passive worshiper. It cannot, it being Baha'i worship, cannot afford lasting satisfaction and benefit to the worshiper himself, much less to humanity in general, unless and until translated and transfused into that dynamic and disinterested service to the cause of humanity, which it is the supreme privilege of the dependencies of the magical Azkar to facilitate and promote. This quotation was circulated by both Counselor Peter Kahn and by Counselor Hooper Dunbar in their travels. And sometimes they would paraphrase it by saying that, referring to Baha'i worship, they kind of compressed this longer sentence of the Guardian and said it this way, that Baha'i worship cannot afford lasting satisfaction to the worshiper himself unless translated and transfused into dynamic and disinterested service to the cause of humanity. Otherwise, it is limited and transitory. That's taking a few key phrases and trying to put it together in some sort of a nugget. But, of course, they warned we're not going into a kind of a warmed-over social work kind of situation either. We're not going to be these do-gooders who are going around putting Band-Aids on the old world order. And that brings us to the third fundamental principle underlying this message, that our work, this work, the work of the faith, is the total reconstruction of society, building a new race of man. You can pull these phrases out of many, many different kinds of Baha'i quotations, so I'm not going to give you page and reference to one or two. This is what we're about. You know, we're spreading the word of God, but we're building a new world order. We're building a new kind of Baha'i community. And our thoughts must be centered on this total kind of building that we're doing, not just teaching about Baha'u'llah and stopping at that point, but the total reconstruction of the world and an ever-advancing civilization. Now, Counselor Peter Kahn also pointed out that as soon as this letter came out, the House of Justice began to receive many, many letters from Baha'is all over the world responding to this, responding to one part or another. Very often with proposals that were very large, very top-heavy, involving a lot of funds and involving a lot of direction from dominant countries into third world countries or developing countries. And he pointed out that in the letter of October 20th, in the third paragraph, the last paragraph of the first page, something that most people who had written letters to the Universal House of Justice with these proposals had missed. And by the way, he said that the response to these proposals was no, no, 1,000 times no. This is not what we're doing. You haven't read the letter, go back and read the letter. But he pointed out that the October 20th letter in this third paragraph said that this process of social and economic regeneration must begin within the Baha'i community itself. We must begin to look at ourselves first and get our own house in order before we go out and change the world. And it was to begin with 3 steps. And this was pointed out in that paragraph. Our learning how to apply spiritual principles, the application of spiritual principles, a rectitude of conduct, distinguishing ourselves with this rectitude of conduct, and learning how to practice the art of consultation. Sure that every Baha'i community in the world needs to practice and begin to apply these kinds of principles. The Baha'i community itself must lift itself up and become self-sufficient and self-reliant. This is all contained in that letter. But very often the friends read quickly and skip certain paragraphs and go on to catchy phrases that they themselves are interested in and go way beyond the point of the letter at that time. He urged that we should get this letter out and study it over and over and over and over again, and that's what we'll be doing in our study class this afternoon. He gave us an example of a very good kind of project, which the House of Justice had noticed, because there were a lot of questions about what kinds of projects do you think there should be and what can we do? And for one thing, he mentioned that perhaps the projects in the Western world would be more social and less economic. And tonight I'll go over a few of the ideas that he had. But he did caution against big top-down kinds of projects, colonial kinds of projects, projects that had that smacked of paternalism between the haves and the have-nots. And also projects which distracted us from teaching. He talked about the fact that much of the aid which had gone into many of the developing countries had come to naught. In fact, to use his phraseology, he said, the third world is littered with burned-out tractors. So we're trying to stay away from this kind of approach to the social and economic development projects. But he did give us a wonderful example of a project that had happened in Zaire in an area with the Pygmies. Now, the Pygmies are nomadic peoples, traditionally nomadic, who are hunters and gatherers. And to make this, I'm going to collapse his story a bit, but they usually move around through the forest scavenging for food and sometimes become beggars around the more settled villages of other peoples. Now, this Pygmy group, imbued with the idea of how they could really develop themselves and help themselves, had now settled down and had built a village, a stable village for themselves, and had actually begun to grow crops in a stable situation and have some sort of animals that they were herding. And so then they left their nomadic way of life and they had settled down and were practicing agriculture, and they decided that they should learn something. So they also asked for some help in learning ABCs and their numbers, 1 to 100. And they began to go to tutorial schools and learn these kinds of things. And a community development officer who was not a Baha'i came out to this village to see what was going on with this Pygmy village. And he saw this, and they all lined up in front of him and recited their ABCs and their numbers from 1 to 100 as an evidence of what they had done for themselves and pulling themselves up by their own bootstraps. And he was so impressed by this that he began to study the Baha'i faith and became a Baha'i. But the House of Justice said that this was a very good kind of development because it was awakening the developmental sense in the people themselves. And they themselves were deciding what they wanted to do and guiding their own destiny with outside help from those who are able to offer some small assistance. Now, When I was in Africa and Councillor Dunbar was there, he spoke for a weekend session with auxiliary board members in Southern Africa, and I was invited to come. And one of the points he stressed was that when you get into these social and economic development projects, and his comments were keyed by a question of one auxiliary board member who really did have a very different kind of idea, that now the aid is coming kind of thing. You know, now we're going to get some sort of assistance. And he wanted to straighten this out. And he said, now, this is not going to be that kind of aid where you just all of a sudden drop in aid. Now the aid is coming. But it's going to be where you find a self-help kind of assistance, where you find these strong local Baha'i communities, a strong nucleus that's been built in the village itself, and where you can move with some self-sufficiency into a project to help better yourselves or better your community with local labor and, to a great extent, local funds and local enthusiasm. Now, this is very different than the normal kind of aid drop where you say, okay, now I need a well, and somebody comes in and does something for you or gives you a well or gives you a tractor. It must have the component of people doing things for themselves. And in this, I think you can see that we can much better find ourselves in a position where these people who have developed to self-sufficiency and self-reliancy will have a certain kind of respect and dignity for themselves and will have built their own confidence level to a greater degree than if we just had some aid drop because we happen to have a lot of money. Now, Councillor Dunbar, again, went over this paradigm which was contained in the quotation from a Baha'i administration. That is, that there is the central edifice, the magical askar, the spiritual heart, and from that, the dependencies come next. In the same way, the spiritual precedes the material, and there develops the strong spiritual local community, and out of that then develops the material aid projects, because they are then able and capable of moving out into the world with their strong spiritual, enthusiastic, unified foundation and moving out and working into some of the aid projects. He also quoted the same letter of October 29th, 1929, about not being able to segregate the human heart from the outside environment, and said it's very important that we see how these two work together and that we recognize this. Since I'm talking about Councillor Dunbar, he also spoke one evening for all of the Baha'is in Harare and Zimbabwe. And he told us two really kind of interesting stories, so I'll digress just a little bit from social and economic development projects because you might be interested in hearing these. He had been making this similar kind of trip through Africa that Councillor Peter Kahn had here, and he had been in Zaire. Now, he'd been there for a two-day meeting, and he took quite a long time telling us about this fantastic meeting, which was probably the most impressive event of his stay in Africa. And he said that he was taken out to this rural area, and he found that this village, which did have a very strong Baha'i community, had built their own center. In fact, they had planted a crop of some sort of crop. I don't know what kind that was, but a special crop that the Baha'i community had planted to earn money so that they could put a roof on the center. And then they decided, well, maybe we'll have guests coming out, or maybe somebody will come and visit us, a visitor. So they said, we'll build a four-room guest house. So they built this four-room guest house also. So when he got out there, well, he was taken to this guest house, and they said, well, maybe you'd like to rest, lie down and rest. You've had a long trip out, and the meeting will begin later on in the afternoon. So he went in and rested, and he kept hearing all these strange noises outside, you know, a lot of people making quite a lot of noise. So when he got up after a couple of hours and went outside, he found that 300 people had arrived for the meeting. And also, they had built a nice shelter. Of course, the people couldn't get into the Baha'i Center. It was too small. But they had built some sort of shelter with leaves and roof so that there was this open-air shelter for them to have a meeting in. So 300 people had arrived. But later, someone came up to him and said, oh, we just heard that 700 more are on their way. And he had, and it was really quite interesting because he said all of this was told to him by the local committee on statistics, which had, and they kept tab on everybody who came, and they'd say how many auxiliary board members were there and how many LSAs were represented, and give him all of the statistical information. So he said that there was one man that really had walked for 10 days to get to this meeting, and one woman who was 75 years old who had walked 300 kilometers to get to this meeting. I'm collapsing his story, too, because it took about 20 minutes to tell all the details of this fantastic meeting. He said after a while, another 300 were coming over the hills, and you know they'd hear some noise, and some more people would come. And finally, in all, they had about 1,800 people there for the meeting. And a lot of board members, a lot of assistants, 156 LSAs were represented, and several choirs, because a lot of the communities had their own choirs. And he said at different times during this two-day meeting, if things got a little rough or things got a little noisy, there were some old ladies that kind of acted as disciplinarians, and the old ladies would step out and shake around and shake their fingers at people and tell them to be quiet, or else they'd get a choir up and get them to sing some song. In the meantime, they decided that they needed to collect some money, so they'd put some big wash tubs with towels very discreetly draped over them, and people kept coming up distributing their money into the wash tubs, and they get higher and higher until the committee on local committee on finances would take the tub aside and begin to count the money, and they'd put another tub there. And they had a lot of different kinds of songs that they sang about many different topics in the faith. That was one of their prime ways of teaching. They had songs about the seven-year plan, or about Mirza Midi, about the tablet of Ahmad. And also there was a great emphasis on memorization of prayers. One woman recited 30 prayers that she knew by heart. Anyway, this was quite a wonderful meeting that went on for these 2 days. And obviously it impressed him, and it left all of us gasping down there too, because we'd never seen anything quite like that in Southern Africa. And we all wanted to know how this was done, because it just connoted such a level of activity on the part of the local believers that most of us don't see out in the pioneering field, and we wanted to know how it had been done. Well, those questions came right after he finished. They said, okay, you know, why is this going on here? He said these were a really very fiery and enthusiastic kind of people, but that they had been persecuted as Baha'is for several years, and now the persecution had been kind of lifted from them, and so he felt that they were very active. But he said he himself didn't know what the answer was, why they were so active. The other story he told was an answer to a question of how is the temple in India coming? And he said that two pedals are now completed, and this is all being built by hand labor, and it's the first building that's been built in India like this with all this hand labor for 50 years. He said most of the workers are women on the project, and he said that sometimes the temperature gets to be 50 to 52 Celsius. I figured that out on my calculator, and it comes to 122 to 125 Fahrenheit, which seems very hot, but he must be quite correct, because he said this presented a problem in pouring the cement, and they had to have special kinds of places where they could keep the cement cool before they took it out and poured the cement, because it was so hot to work out there. He said the overseer went to Britain, and he was a bit worried when he went. He was going to be gone for some weeks, that the quality would kind of go down and that mistakes would be made. But the inspector and the architect went out to observe what was going on, and they said that everything was just working very smoothly, and everything was on time and was proceeding quite well. The mayor of New Delhi had visited the site and had stayed for a couple of hours looking around at the temple, and he wrote in the visitor's book, "This has been a spiritual pilgrimage, and the building is not yet finished. Imagine what it will be like when it is finished." So those are just a couple of stories that he shared with us, and I thought you'd be interested in hearing about that. Now, just to put development, the whole area of development, into perspective, let's look at the outside world and what kind of development has been going on over the last, since the end of World War II, when we began to get into what we call the development field. Now, there was a dominant paradigm or model which was used all during the 50s and 60s and up into the 70s that had to do with, to a very great extent, with quantitative or materialistic kinds of measures. I'm going to read a bit from Everett Rogers, who is a writer in communication and development, as he explains what the idea was from this dominant model of development, which grew up after World War II and which influenced developmental thinking. Through the late 1960s, a dominant paradigm ruled intellectual definitions and discussions of development and guided national development programs. This concept of development grew out of certain historical events, such as the Industrial Revolution in Europe and the United States, the colonial experience in Latin America, Africa, and Asia, the quantitative empiricism of North American social science, and capitalistic economic political philosophy. Implicit in the ruling paradigm were numerous assumptions which were generally thought to be valid or at least not widely questioned till into the 1970s. Definitions of development centered around the criterion of the rate of economic growth. The level of national development at any given point in time was the gross national product. Gross national product. That was the aggregate of everything that was made in the country. And when divided by the total population of the nation, it became per capita income. Although there was a certain amount of intellectual discomfort with per capita income as the main index of development, especially among non-economists, alternative measures and definitions of development had relatively few proponents. So we had this view that development was to increase somehow gross national product in a certain country, and it was the theory at that time, which was called the trickle-down theory, that if we increase this gross national product, that everybody in the country would somehow benefit from this, both the people who were wealthy and the people who were poor. It was a little too sophisticated at that time to begin to think about whether that was happening or not. We just kind of naively assumed that if we increased the size of this pie, everybody got a little bit bigger slice. Unfortunately, that didn't happen, as we're going to see. Now, when we got to the 1970s, a lot of the development writing began to focus on the equality of distribution. And we found, lo and behold, that this had not happened. Unfortunately, the rich had got richer and the poor had got poorer. And we hadn't done very much to help the rural poor at all and develop the rural areas. There had been little or no change. Sometimes the change was for the worse, depending upon population densities. Now, implicit in this model that I was talking about, the early model, which we'll call Western model, top-down model, trickle-down model, whatever you want to call it, there was a kind of intellectual ethnocentrism. We believed that everybody wanted to be kind of like us in the 1950s. You know, we were kind of bumptious and enthusiastic and riding on the post-war booms. And we believe that everybody all over the world would love to have an economy just like us. Well, that was not necessarily so. But we felt that this was the way nations should advance. And so we analyzed everything that happened on this basis, that the nation should be advancing towards us. Let's just take nation X in the third world or developing world. If it was not advancing in its economy and society, not advancing towards what we were doing and what our standards were, then what were the stumbling blocks? And then we always looked internally to find out what was keeping that nation from developing and becoming a carbon copy of what the Western world was like. Now, We never looked at the external causes. We never looked at what we as a capitalistic nation or the multinational corporations were doing to the underdeveloped countries. We only looked at these internal kinds of causes, the traditional cultures, the peasants being pessimistic or fatalistic. No. The economic systems being different, and why didn't they change and become more in conformity with ours or the political system? We wanted to change things so that they modeled us. Again, in the 70s, we began to redefine these causes of underdevelopment and look at the outside constraints, the external world constraints for development, as well as these internal stumbling blocks. We began to look at the international terms of trade that big nations imposed upon small nations. We began to look at the economic imperialism of big multinational corporations where there was so much control. We began to look at the vulnerability and dependability of these small nations on different kinds of aid programs and what these were in fact doing to the countries. Also in the 70s, we began to develop new approaches and get new ideas. The Small is Beautiful book came out with Schumacher. And we began to think about intermediate technology or small technology, whereas before we just thought of this stuff as second rate. You know, and if we wanted to be really nice developers, we wanted to give them a big tractor that came from here because that was the best we could provide. Now, as we looked at Small is Beautiful, we thought maybe, you know, it's not so good to give them the big tractor. Remember, as Peter Kahn said, the third world is littered with burned out tractors. But to give them something that will keep on running and not burn out quite so quickly. We also looked at some of the problems that we were having as far as ecology and environment were concerned, some of the pollution problems. And we began to question, too, whether our models were exactly the right models to have everybody try to emulate. So we began to question what we were doing ourselves. During the world oil crisis, this showed us very clearly in bringing many of the developed nations kind of to their knees that small nations or developing nations could somehow become very rich overnight and could become major forces in the world economy. And this it didn't take necessarily a long time for this kind of phenomenon to happen. At the same time, we saw the opening of China, and we began to learn a lot about China. And we looked at some of their programs where they had modernized health services, education services, and they had not asked for or taken any kind of outside aid. And the technology or the resources used in development were very different from the old Western top-down kinds of models that we were talking about. Also, Cuba and Tanzania and Chile also had learning experiences for us to look at some of their projects that had gone on and to learn from these different techniques and alternatives to the monolithic kind of development plans that we had once focused on. And lastly, we just saw that development wasn't going too well. We hadn't done too much. You know, we'd had 20 years of development work, and we really hadn't accomplished a lot of the objectives that we had set out to do. So it just wasn't working too well. I can give you some examples of working on a development projects or going in to work on proposals for development projects where people never really got out into the rural area and looked around to find out what was going on in the rural area. Ben Glamini and I were just talking about this at lunchtime. That when I was there in Swaziland one time, I happened to have a car because I was pioneering in Lesotho at that time. And so I suggested to the rest of my team that was writing this proposal, well, let's go out and look at this rural development area. Let's get in the car and go out and look at it. And they said, yeah, what? Can we do that? And most time, if you're from the World Bank or AID or you're from one of the development groups, CETA, whatever it is coming in, you go to the capital, you sit down around the table, you work in your AID office or your UN office, You work by interviewing the ministers or the permanent secretaries of the country that you're in, but you never get out and talk to the people. You never get out and talk to the woman who's going to be affected when they say, okay, let's move all the houses into the village, and so we're going to scrape your land, and you have to move your house over here. They never get out and talk to somebody like that and find out how that's going to affect their life or their fortunes or what's going to happen, whether it's going to make them destitute or not. So I think there's a great deal more of that realization that this thing was kind of sterile to begin with, and the aid projects were made without looking really at people and what happened to the people. Now, the new elements that have been inculcated into the newer models of development sound much more close to our Baha'i concepts. And it's nice to know that the outside world is catching up with us. And we feel a lot more comfortable maybe working in development at this period in time than we did 20 or 30 years ago. Because some of the main elements have to do with this focus on equality of chance, of distribution of goods, and the fact that that if you just are creating a system where the rich get richer and the poor get poorer, that's not really development. But the focus should be on the poor or the rural areas and how they can have priority to close this gap. The second element would be popular participation in self-development, planning, and execution. Here's the grassroots approach coming in again that's been mentioned in our October 20th letter. And a knowledge that people cannot be developed, but people have to develop themselves. It can't be something that you do to people, but it has to be something that people are encouraged to do for themselves. Self-reliance and independence. I've got to go over these real quickly because Dwight's going to be pushing me off the podium here. That it's possible to integrate the traditional with the modern, that you don't have to scrape away the whole traditional system and then just put in some sort of Western model of politics or economic system or social system, but there can be some sort of synchronization of the old and the new ideas. And boy, I'll tell you, in the old projects, very often it was the anthropologist was the only one that raised his or her lonely voice to say, hey, boy, you don't know what you're going to be doing to these people if you put through this project. They just did not realize some of the implications of what was going to happen. Now there's been a lot of redefinition of what is development, and it's a much more humanistic, a much more Baha'i approach. Let me read this paragraph and close with this. What is development? Out of the various criticisms of the dominant paradigm of development grew a questioning of the concept of development, from one that had centered on the materialistic economic growth to a definition that implied such other valued ends as social advancement, equality and freedom. These valued qualities should be determined by the people themselves through a widely participatory process. Thus, each nation might pursue a somewhat different pathway to development, depending on exactly what style of development was desired. We summarize these newer conceptions of development by defining development as a widely participatory process of social change in society, intended to bring about both social and material advancement, including greater equality, freedom, and other valued qualities for the majority of the people through their gaining greater control over their environment. And Rogers footnoted, in kind of a tongue-in-cheek fashion, he said, please note how this has changed from my old definition of years ago. And when he had this definition, development is a type of social change in which new ideas are introduced into a social system. Note how different that is. In order to produce higher per capita incomes and levels of living through more modern production methods and improved social organization. So just in a span of a few years, he's changed his definition from one to the other. Now, this evening, I want to talk about the fact that many Christian groups and many other social action groups are recognizing the need for this kind of change, too, and to read you a few quotations from a Catholic bishop in Tanzania and then show you some development materials, which I picked up in Zimbabwe, which were made by Christian groups, social action groups, and a lot of other groups that are getting into literacy training and the fields of social and economic development, and then tell you a little bit about some of the Baha'i projects that are going on in Africa, too.